Okay, a very good evening. Thank you everyone for joining. We are on to our next step in our Kashrus series focused on more advanced, like what a Mashkiach or Mashkicha would be thinking of in terms of Kashering. And I'd like to begin by simply identifying the two typical methods of Hechsher, and then we would get into some of the text. So basically, when we're talking about Kashering, it's based largely on the Psukim in Parshas Matos, where they went to war against Midian, and Moshe instructed them that they would have to kasher the food utensils before using them. Interestingly, it also mentions that they're going to have to tovel them before they're going to be ready for use in the kosher kitchen. And on a few occasions, we're going to show the distinction between toveling and kashering, even though both may be immersing in water in certain circumstances. But there really are differences. But the kashering is basically falls into two different categories. One is called hag'alah, which is immersing in water. And the other is called libun, which is exposure to high open flame heat, to the point that whatever is contained therein gets burnt. The assumption in all of kashering is that there is something in the walls of the vessel that's been absorbed when it was used with non-kosher or milchiks versus fleishiks type of applications. And what's in the walls of the keli has to be pulled out or burnt in place, however we do that. And it's interesting that in our time where there's more awareness of allergy type reactions, we actually find that this is known scientifically, that there is some sort of residual something in the walls of the machinery, and it shows up very specifically with dairy allergies, that sometimes even when we consider it clean and acceptable on an allergy level, it may still be showing up, and that's why they have to do their disclaimers, and sometimes we're certifying it with a P Pariv designation, and it's still getting a warning that it may have some sort of dairy residual effects. But in any case, these two methods, hagala, purging in water, and libun, burning it by an open fire, are the two typical methods of kashering, and they are used kibolo kachpolto to parallel the way that the food was absorbed. If the food was absorbed through water, for example, you cooked meatballs in a pot, so it's got water, it's got sauce, it's bubbling, so the method of kashering for that pot is going to be with water. If, however, a person took a frying pan or even a shallow type pot or whatever might be useful and used it to fry hamburgers, latkes, whatever it may be, but you're using very little oil, just enough to grease the pan, but you recognize that what you're doing is frying, not cooking, then the method of kashering such a thing, if you want it in the case of latkes, for example, if it was chametz stick and you wanted to upgrade for Pesach, or the case of hamburgers and you wanted to make it milchik, so the method of kashering in such a case is going to reflect that it was not used with water boiling, it was used frying, which is an open fire type of method, and therefore it's going to require libun, open fire kashering, very high heat to the open flame. The difference between these methods on a practical level is enormously significant. Number one, boiling up a pot of water is not that hard. Many of us, because we haven't been trained in kashering, so we shy away from it, but it's an emotional issue that we have to overcome, or an intellectual, scholastic. It's not a hard thing to boil up a pot of water. In contrast, when you're dealing with open flame kashering, if it was frying, it really requires either a blowtorch or a self-clean oven or however, whatever method we're going to use. It's not such a simple thing to get that high-level heat. And that's compounded by another factor, which is that sometimes if the item indeed needs libun, this high-level open-flame heat, it simply won't be able to be kashered because we're worried that it would ruin the item and therefore you would not reliably bring it up to that level of heat. If a frying pan has a special Teflon nonstick coating, so even if the person says, okay, I'll kasher it, it's not so simple, because if you were to heat it up to that point, it would probably ruin the functionality of the pan, and therefore we have a halacha that any kashering that would typically ruin the functionality of the item, we are worried that you're not going to do the kashering properly, and therefore the kashering simply can't be done. To jump ahead of ourselves by a few steps, in heavy industrial settings, there are hashgachas that allow that the company sign off that they do not hold the kashering agency liable if it breaks. And then they bring in a team of mashgichim and they kasher these items that are iffy, and it's hit and miss. Some of them make it through the kashering process and some don't. And some kashering agencies hold that that's sufficient, that if the rabbi who's coming in is two levels removed from the owner of the company, and the company is trying to go kosher and says, listen, either it's garbage or you try to kasher it. So some, but I'm not looking to paskin the shayla, and I'm not looking to identify agencies, looking to point out that kind of workaround is highlighting the challenge that exists if an item cannot be easily kashered by the typical methods without getting ruined. So let's begin with page 1, Hagalah. The Shulchan Aruch in Hilchas Pesach, which is where a tremendous amount of the laws of kashering are found, because Pesach is the typical time that we are intensely involved in this. Obviously, many of these rules are going to be extrapolated to all year. You have a milchik fleshik mess up, or you buy a used item, or you inherit a non-kosher item in one way or another from somebody who didn't reliably keep kosher, and you want to know what do you need to do. So the laws of kashering are always going to come into play. Sakinim, you have knives. Mag'ilan b'kli rishon umutarim. You can kasher them, you could do hagalah, in a first keli, in a first vessel, and it is permitted. What is a first vessel? And here we have one of the important laws of kashering, is that the level of heat of the water is very significant. The original vessel that's on the heat source is called a kli rishon. We're looking that it should be a kli rishon, an original pot, and that it should be ma'ale resichos, that it's bubbling. How bubbling is a matter of discussion between poskim, practical level, how bubbling. The best, obviously, on a practical level, is it should be bubbling. It should be noticeably bubbling. the challenge that we sometimes encounter is that if you put items, especially metal items, in too quickly, it could cool down the water to the point that it may indeed not anymore be kashering level of heat. That's why sometimes it becomes necessary to utilize a cover, even though the cover has nothing to do with the kashering process per se, but you got to build up your heat again. When I do kashering typically before Pesach, and I don't want to involve myself with covers for whatever reason, we'll discuss whether you use chametz tikkapatz or Pesach tikkapatz or whatever, so I just make sure that I have a roll of heavy-duty aluminum foil on hand, and I cover my pots with the heavy-duty. I fold it in a little bit, and it works as a cover to retain the heat, builds up the heat until I'm ready to do the kashering. If I lose the heat in the middle, I just cover it again. Be patient. 5-10 minutes, you'll have your heat back in place. Yeah?
And you're talking about knives. Are you talking about knives with certain type of handles?
Beautiful. So there are two downsides to knives, and that's why I love this presentation, because it's a perfect opportunity for discussion. One downside consideration with knives is that sometimes knives have joints, and therefore it's brought in many areas of halacha, knives can't be kashered. So, I mean, what does it mean knives can't be kashered? It's not because it's a knife. It's because if it's got be'en, anything tangible, stuck, residual, that's going to be a problem. Because you can't kasher anything residual with simply putting it into water. You want to kasher something that's residual, that spot is going to require a blowtorch to burn out whatever is residual. So one consideration with knives is that if they are with a handle, for example, a wooden handle, which is very common, you're going to have to be aware that at that joint, you could have something that will cause it to be impossible to kasher unless you take special action. The other issue with knives, which is also very textual based, the Gemara mentions this, that knives are going to require libun, open fire kashering, and not hagalah. And the poskim say that that's because they used to use their knives like spatulas or spits. They used to put the food directly onto the knife. They'd pierce it with the knife. They would put it on the open flame, in which case the word for that object may be knife, but it's not knife the way we think of a knife, which is at the table to use a knife. That knife was actually being used as a spit. It would be the equivalent of a grill, of a barbecue grate, and it needs a whole different level of kashering, open coals with intense heat. So we're bringing sakinim over here. We're talking about the knives that are at our tables. They can be kashered in water, provided that there are no joints or anything like that to consider, in which case many of our knives are perfectly kasherable. You have a stainless steel set of knives, no wooden handles, for example. It's just as kasherable as a fork. Question? Someone? Nope. Thought I saw. Okay. Kodem hagola. I'm continuing in the text. Tzorach l'shofam yofa. You got to clean them really well. B'mashchezes. Either you file it down. And this always astounds people when they just read translations from texts from like 300 years ago. So it says that you take your dining room table and you just file it down. Mm-hmm. No, if it's a wooden table, so just file it down. And you look at this like, I don't think so. But that's where that's coming from, that one solution was that they would be filing down the top level, Kedei Kalipa perhaps. Oberi Chaim, over here it's not even talking about that, it's just talking about getting rid of the schmutz. Lahavir kol chaluda shabem, to get rid of any residue, kodem hechsherim, before you kasher it. Hilkach, therefore. Im yesh bo gumos, if it has crevices. And again, I don't know how intensely we need to apply this to our utensils. Our utensils are manufactured. There's a far better quality than some home shop craftsman who's putting two things together with a wedge and kind of making it work. I don't mean to sound facetious. I mean, sometimes the old craftsmen were far better than even our best crafted stuff. But the typical stuff that people had was patched over the years. And in halacha, we're very concerned that eino yochel nakoso yafed, that they weren't able to clean it properly. I asked my Rebbe about this once. You know, I said, you know, does that mean all wooden handles, all steak knives type things can't be kashered because of the text, the way it's brought? And he said, you know, you have to make an assessment. Either yeah or no. I mean, if it has the problem they describe, then you can't. If it doesn't have the problem they describe, then you could. It's very simple. So simple that the minig was that you always had the rav of the city do the kashering.
You're bringing all of the dishes that need, or all our dishes that need to be kashered to your house.
It's an idea. You should clear it with my wife. Yes.
Between something like a knife that has a handle that you're using at the table, that you might have to remove that handle or do something special, versus if you had a pot that has a handle that you know is never going to touch any food.
Our assumption, our working assumption in halacha, is that the handles of pots have to be kashered just as the pot has to be kashered, and we really don't make any distinction. If we have time, I may be able to tell you some creative ways. Sometimes if the handles can be removed, it may open up some of our options as to how to kasher the vessel. Sometimes you have a pot, for example, that has a plastic or other artificial type knob on the top. And when I make a suggestion that one method of kashering is to simply pop it in the oven for a period of time, and you look at me, well, I can't do that to the knob. The knob's going to melt, get misshapen. So in such cases, we might tell you to unscrew the knob, kasher the knob in one way, in boiling water, and perhaps kasher the pot in a different way in the oven. And then afterwards, after everything's cooled down, you reattach them. You know, it's like the two minyanim and chol hamoed, that after they take off the tefillin, they can join again. Okay. So everybody gets special treatment.
So are the wedges of, like, that handle on the pot, on the handle of the pot, the joint, where the pot, no, on the pot itself. On the pot itself.
Here?
Yeah, so are those joints the same as, like, a joint on a knife?
If there's residue there, we're going to be nervous about that. And that's where the concept of an open flame, whether it's a blowtorch or it's simply an open flame, is going to come into play. I once witnessed someone pointed out that sometimes under a pot, under the lid of the pot, there's junk. And you think you're kashering the pot because you did the overflow method and, you know, you heated up a brick. And you did, we'll maybe do that in a subsequent session. You know, how to do that. It overflows very nice. But if they're caked up noodles underneath here, you didn't kasher that for Pesach. That doesn't work. And some sort of fire method has to be gotten in there to burn that to ash so that it's no longer food type material. So you could do something as simple as a candle, and you just wait. until you no longer see a glow under there. In other words, when you first start, you're going to see a glow. It's burning stuff. Eventually, it stabilizes, and then you could rotate the pot. It could take you a half hour. It could take you longer. I don't know how long it'll take you. It depends on your heat mechanism, your fire mechanism. Eventually, you'll be able to burn out everything there and do a successful kashering. But you have to be able to look with a critical eye at your utensil to know what concerns might there be. Yeah?
What about chemicals? Couldn't you put a chemical on there?
So I noticed as I was talking that consideration. Chemical works for Pesach. In other words, if you want to make sure something's not food grade, you'd simply pour some chemical on it, some detergent, a little bleach, and you've made a declaration that it's not chametz food grade anymore. When you're doing kashering, though, we're truly worried not just about your intention, but is it going to emit a chametzdik taste? And I'm not positive at what point you can reliably do that other than getting rid of it. In other words, spraying from a spritz bottle some bleach underneath this thing, I would not accept on a kashering level, even though I would totally accept that on a cleaning for Pesach level. You've made a declaration. No one's eating that consciously. Yeah?
I had 30-some years ago, I had a silver kiddush cup that I wanted to kosher for Pesach, and I was told because the way it's made, the metal curves over and forms a lip, that you can't clean out in there. That stuff does get caught in there when you're washing it. Would I be able to do, like you said, with a candle?
There's a workaround. The workaround is, if you are willing to burn out whatever's in there, at risk, of course, of discoloring your silver becher, it's a lot worse than tarnish. I mean, it's open flame. I don't know. I don't know what happens. I'm not a silversmith. Obviously, it does get exposed to open flame because they do it all the time. It's called soldering. But if you could do it, it works. Because then the chametz is no longer there. It's been burnt out. And that's not even called, that itself, what I'm describing here, is not even called libun, really. It's physically eradicating the residue. There's another thing that's actually called libun, which is if there's a patch, if there's a thing, and for some reason water is not getting there, so then there's a libun method of kashering, which you can use. This is pre-kashering. This is just getting the vessel ready for kashering. That's the last, the last four words in the paragraph we were doing. V'tzorech libun b'makom hagumos. In the place of the holes, you're going to require libun. Part of it is the residue. Part of it is, like if there's a patch there, the water's not getting where it would have gotten pre the patch, where the things were originally absorbed. Okay. Now, this is Hagola. We're not yet entering Libun until the next paragraph. But I want to point out that there is a method of high heat, of Libun, which sometimes can be utilized, and that's what I was alluding to before, which is sometimes, this is really where it comes up the most, a person is aware that in order to kasher a pot, you need to overflow so that just as you spilled the soup or meatballs or whatever, noodles, over the lid, over the rim, so you're going to have to kasher the rim. How do you kasher the rim? You overflow. There are different methods of overflowing. The most messy and traditional is to put a heated rock into the pot, and it overflows like a geyser at high heat. It's phenomenal. It's an experience. Personally, I don't recommend doing it on your stovetop. There's a risk of overflowing and hitting electronic mechanisms, etc. When I did it, until I came up with some other methods that I think are just much more user-friendly, like investing in a koshering pot and therefore not having to kosher back and forth each year, I have a koshering pot, and I put it away as a koshering pot. But before I did that, I lifted the pot off the stove, put it on a, I had a cinder block, whatever, something that's heat resistant. And then I did this brick method into it, which brings up the heat tremendously and forms your geyser, but it's on the floor, pre-applied towels around it, and it's relatively not so messy.
That takes a long time to heat that rock.
The rock actually is interesting, is not the biggest challenge. The challenge is bringing up the water in a very large pot to boil. That's really where the problem is. The rock, my experience is that it heats up pretty fast. I don't remember, I haven't done it in a few years, but my recollection was 15, 20 minutes, and that rock is all you need.
Just
what?
Put it on the grate?
Yeah.
Can you have a smaller pot of boiling water that you pour onto that?
There are a lot of different tricks, and whoever's doing your hashkacha is going to give you your recommendation. There are methods that you could use. Typically, though, it's still going to be overflowing. It's still going to be producing the same mess-type situation. I invested in a brick with a metal handle, and therefore, I don't go near the brick itself. I remember the first year I did it, I was actually, like, balancing the brick between pliers and, what you know, wrenches. I figured out how to move it safely. But after that, I bought a... I didn't bring it tonight. I couldn't find it on my way out. But you just immerse it in, and the brick is attached to a metal tongs, and you just touch the metal tongs. It's far more controllable. Yeah?
I just want to ask a little bit about the koshering pot. If you have a pot you set aside for koshering, you kind of imply, first of all, you don't need to have it boil over. You need to kosher that pot before you can... kosh other things, and you can use that pot to kosh it for just fleishiks. Does that mean something that you think was had a time of fleish, then can you still, do you have to re-kosh the pot to use it for milpiks? Do you have a separate pot? Or?
So, I'm just going to answer your question to keep it simple, even though we could be considerably more useful and more lenient, but just to stick to your question, if you invested in a koshering pot, then you're certainly not going to have to kosher the koshering pot before you use it. It's a new pot.
But
there's no reason to kosher.
If you had something that was a fleishik.
Good. So now you're asking, I have a fleishik utensil, which I koshered in my koshering pot. What is the status of my koshering pot now? So what you want to do is always, 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 probably the most important principle of koshering. It'll save you all kinds of mishaps. Always make sure that the items you're using in koshering are more than 24 hours from their last use. Always. More than 24 hours. In Hebrew, eino ben yomo, not current. Because what happens is, if the taste that's being emitted from this is less than 24 hours, I have to deal with it. I got to be a scholar. I got to know, so what does it do? It's not bar not. Does it affect me? Not. Do I have shishim 60 times? Where does it leave me? If this is more than 24 hours old, then the taste that's coming out is called tam pogum, damaged taste, negative taste, and it's not going to affect my pot at all. This gets even more lenient than I'm describing, in that most people do not have a koshering pot and don't need to have a koshering pot. The primary usefulness of a koshering pot is for Pesach. But in general, all you need to do, you have a mishap. You like to use these for frankfurters. Someone did some brilliant move and ended up somewhere in the winter. I haven't used it for Frankfurters in months. Someone went and picked up some hot cheese with it. Now, after I flip out, what do I have to do? Yeah? So all you have to do, really, is ask a shayla. If the psak, as would be in the case that I very carefully outlined for you, I'll try to explain later why, but if the psak is that it just needs hagala, water, you simply take a pot that has not been used in 24 hours, milchik, fleishik, makes no difference, and you simply wait till this is 24 hours from that dastardly incident, and you will immerse it in boiling water,
totally immersed,
in the non-24-hour pot with the non-24-hour item, and it's going to be kashered. You asked if it has to be immersed totally. The answer is yes, it has to be immersed totally, but a distinction is drawn between this and immersing it in a mikvah. Tevilas kelim works differently. Tevilas kelim has to be immersed all at once, just like a person has to be immersed all at once. If a person trying to go to mikvah keeps their pinky out and then immerses their pinky separately, it's not a good tevila. Likewise, if you try to immerse this till here, I don't want to get burnt. Hot water. You put it in, right? That's okay. You kasher till the water line. How are you going to kasher the other part? So you need something that's heat resistant and water resistant. You take it and you immerse the other side. And that's fine. As long as it all got immersed, you're good to go. This is the challenge, though, that if you would put this in and then try to go like this, it would be one heavy ouch. Many, many people working in Ashgacha have forgotten themselves and have gotten burnt. That's one of the biggest hazards, is just forgetting that it's hot. I purposely took something with wooden handles. Number one, so that I had something to illustrate my issue of crevices. And number two, to illustrate that wood can be kashered. Wood is one of the materials that could be kashered. Yeah. Yes.
A very big chopping block, like on the top of an island. And it's very well made, and everything is smooth and tightened. However, it can develop certain cracks along where they abut each other or the crack in between. Now, in the past, I had to, the boiling water washed it down, and also sanded it off the top.
That's the common custom. You sand it down, and that gets rid of the crevice issue. And then you use whatever boiling water method is being required on that surface.
The same thing for wooden spoons?
A wooden spoon, a piece of sandpaper, should be able to take care of irregularities. I would think so. Again, the custom always was that when they kashered as a communal presentation, as a communal application, they would have a Talmud Chacham present, and he would glance at everything as it came in. Anything that he said needed additional scrutiny, he would pull out and check. But that's because of all these considerations. Greg?
Yeah, with a glass top type stove service, assuming it can be koshered, does it need to be koshered before you put the big pot on and do the koshering in it?
Make sure that everything is eina ben yomo.
Okay.
Everything is more than 24 hours from its last use.
Okay.
After that, probably in the Pesach session, I'll, you know, like itemize exactly the recommended method.
Okay.
But in terms of the scholarship of kashering, make sure it's clean and it's more than 24 hours. After that, it's hard to imagine going wrong.
And that gets the 24 on the
stovetop
as well.
Yeah.
So you have this pot, and you've collected all the silverware throughout the year, and you have a little lidmochitz, leishiks, and treif, and pesach, and whatever. Can you throw that all in there to kosher together, and then, you know, I mean, after it's clean, and or are you supposed to be, like, is your pesach kosher, will really have to be separate from your non-pesach kosher?
No. So everything can be done together. Everything can be done together. There is no restriction. You're kashering, you're kashering. It's going to make it fresh, like new. It's going to be good. You can't just throw it in, though, because we're worried, number one, that the water temperature is going to drop dramatically before it kashers. And number two, that things might not be exposed in the normal way of use. A fork, if it was stacked, imagine an extreme case where I bundle them and dump it in, that's not going to be a good kashering.
Right, but you could,
that's the equivalent of a patch put on a pot, which doesn't work because it's not exposed in the way it was when it absorbed. So the way it's taught is that you should drop them in one at a time, monitoring the heat, just paying attention to it. Of course, if you keep the silverware in a relatively warmish place, like near the kitchen counter, as opposed to in the basement where it's chilly, or something like that, it's going to affect your kashering, and it depends how much patience you have. I have taken silverware that was stored in a cold place. You know, I came in to do someone's kashering, and they handed me the stuff. It was from the shed, and I'm sitting there popping it in, and until I realized, yeah, it's cold. It's killing my heat. So if you just keep near the stove area where it's a little warmer, you won't have that problem. It's a silly little consideration, but yeah, when you use the expression, can I dump it all in? The answer is halachically, yeah, you could, but it's not going to do it. But it's a little nuance of paying attention that's going to make all the difference. Yeah.
Is it better to do one at a time?
That's the way it's taught. We do them one at a time. You take the silverware, you drop it in, drop in the next one. You should not lose your heat, hopefully. But if you did, you'd notice. Yeah.
If you're doing one at a time, do you need to remove the previous one before you put the next one in them?
That's not the minig.
Okay.
It's brought that you're supposed to wash it off in cold water after the fact. In practice, we do not always pull it out and wash it in cold water right away. Sometimes when we're all done, we'll dump the water and add cold water to try to be mekayim that, to try to fulfill that tradition. The reason that we're lenient, really, is because we're not experts at precision hagalah. We're not experts at precision kashering to the point that we would put it in for just the right number of seconds and then pull it out. We don't know exactly that level of precision, and that's why we always kasher teina ben yomo, more than 24 hours old, so that even if it stays in longer, nothing damaging is going to happen to your kashering, because even the water that's sitting there boiling is only absorbed with older than 24-hour taste, and it's not going to hurt you. And that's one of the many benefits of being careful that it should be aged more than 24 hours. Questions? We're good? Let's move on. Libun, second paragraph. Kelim shemishtamshim b'em al yedei ha'or. Items that were used to an open flame. Tzurichim libun. They're going to require open flame kashering. Think for a moment about your oven grate. Your oven grate. Most people, I believe, do not bake bread, for example, directly on the grate, which causes us significant leniency that we don't consider those grates to be intensely chametz. But they require kashering, but they're not intensely chametz. Your toaster oven, though, a person does put bread on the grate of the toaster oven, which would mean that those grates are the same as a barbecue grill grates, where you cook on the grates. It would require high heat, open flame kashering, which would basically ruin the grate. And that's why the word on the street is that toaster oven grates cannot be kashered. Had you only required putting it into a pot of water, oh, I could do that. But that wouldn't be enough because it requires libun. Keep in mind that if a person did use their oven grates directly for food, number one, presumably they would require tevila because it's a kli su'uda, and you would have to put those racks into mikvah before you use them. And number two, when it comes to Pesach kashering, they are going to require a significant, diligent kashering as opposed to the typical grates that we talk about, that you just turn the oven on high heat and we assume it's kashered within a certain number of minutes, whatever, hour, whatever the numbers are exactly. But the concept, which is what we're focused on, is that a basic kashering will be quite easy.
Quick question on that.
Yeah.
Are we concerned for little drops that sometimes spill over directly?
Right. But what type of kashering will be required if something saucy, for example, spilled on the grates?
If your cake batter.
Hagala. Okay. It's liquidy, it's not liquidy. It's a well-taken observation. That isn't its typical method of use, though. And kashering sometimes follows, I mean, together with other considerations, but one of the considerations is what is its typical method of use. And its typical method of use is not to come into direct contact with food. That particular item, an oven grate, does not typically come in contact with food. It's a good observation. I'm not looking to negate it, but in practical, it's not going to cause us to take it any more intensely. Okay. On the last line of the paragraph, we have an important principle. Dovar shedino behagala, an item that requires hagala, boiling water, rak sheyesh bo sedokim, but it has cracks, crevices. It's hard to rely on that method. Osha machmirim lelabno, or for whatever reason, person decides, like we gave an example, I don't want to do the overflow method. It's going to mess up my freshly cleaned kitchen. Have water splattering all over. Sagi belibun kal, you could voluntarily do libun, which is the open fire heat method, and it'll work for Hagala. Libun kal does not require a blowtorch. It doesn't have to be that intense, direct heat beaming on it. Libun kal is what we do on our ovens. We turn it up to 550. Even if you don't have a self-clean oven, you just turn it up to the highest level, and you let it burn itself out. That's called Libun kal, the lesser level of Libun. And I mentioned earlier that that's where I would go ahead and use, if I wanted to kasher the pot, and I didn't want to do the overflow method, I would pop the pot into the oven. The oven is preheated. I know that it's at 550 now. It'll drop a little in heat. as I open and close the oven, essentially, it's at 550. I leave the pot in for a period of time, perhaps 20 minutes. It depends on the thickness of this pot, how long it takes for it to get hot. But essentially, I have a very low maintenance, low intensive type way to kasha this pot. And this is what I was doing for years. I just popped the pot in the oven, left it there for 20 minutes. It hit the intense heat that it needs to. And that, the Mechaber is telling us, is the equivalent of Hagala. Libun Kal, the equivalent of Hagala. The only consideration that you need is good heat-resistant mittens, and you're fine. Okay. Question?
Oh, well, what if you're concerned about pulling out of the oven, could you, after it's been in for 20 minutes, can you just turn the oven off and let it dry?
For sure. Some people just let it cool down, shut the oven with the touch of a button, and let it cool down. Sometimes that's the most useful, like if you're kashering late at night and you just want to go to sleep, you just, yeah, I'm done. Done? Shut it in the morning. It's perfectly safe. Okay.
With Libun Kal, is there a, does it need to be at 550, or can it be just, I mean, with something it only requires Libun Kal because it really needs a gala, but we're just being machmer, so it can, this Libun Kal can be enough. So it really needed only 212 in a boiling hot water. How hot does the oven need to be in order to be accomplished?
There are numbers that the kashrus agencies would work with, but for educational purposes, we aim for the 550 and we just leave it at that. I have never encountered anybody who can tell me he has a good reason why 450 would be so much easier than 550 that we have to actually give up sack. 212 would not work. It's not libun. But I mean, that's what works by water. That's not what works by heating a thing intensely to burn it out. But admittedly, 550 is not the magic number. It's just consensus among poskim that the 550, which is typical on our contemporary ovens, will do the trick. So we aim for that. If a person knows his oven is a little old and it's not quite getting 550, we're not going to tell him he can't make Pesach. We're going to, I mean, whatever, we'll work it out. How much you could go lower is a matter of discussion. I want to share with you a very exciting leniency. And specifically, the Mishnah Berurah says that this does not work for Pesach, but it is a very practical leniency, and really it's delightful to me because it happened to me. When I had my first child and she was precocious enough to be rummaging in the kitchen one morning, so Friday morning after we had done our Shabbos shopping on Thursday, she took a piece of kishka, fleishik, and she put it into the milchik toaster oven. And she turned it on. And it was on long enough for it to start dripping. I came running in, and to me, it looked like a classic case of fleishik in milchik, toaster oven, thin grate. You can't kasher that with an open fire reliably. And I thought, gone. Even on the toaster oven itself, it's a cavity with fleishik. I mean, my grate is gone, my toaster oven is, I'm not sure what I'm dealing with over here. I asked my Rebbe the question, and what he taught me at that time is a basic halacha in kashering, which I had not at that time learned in depth yet. The rule is that if what's being absorbed is hetera bola, kosher at the time that it's absorbed, then even an item that needs libun, type of kashering, is going to be able to get by with Hagolah. It's going to be able to get by with the lower level of kasher. And in this case, it's considered hetera bala. Why? Because we knew that the toaster oven had not been used with milchiks for a few days. That was the case. And therefore, when it absorbed the fleishiks, it's absorbing a non-active milk-meat mixture. And therefore, the method of kashering for this grate, after you clean it meticulously, method of kashering for the grate is hagalah, water. It does not require libun. This is an enormous leniency. I don't mean it in a negative way. I mean it in a practical way. It saves many a frying pan. Because as I mentioned, frying pans, if they're non-stick coated, if you had to pop them into your self-clean oven, it would probably kill the non-stick property, and it wouldn't be the same. If, however, we can verify that your milchik frying pan is not so currently milchik, and therefore, when someone came and did fleishiks on it, accidentally, whatever, they weren't allowed to. It is milchik l'chatchila. But if someone did batch up, if it's more than 24 hours from its last use, you're able to kasher it through hagala boiling water, and that's something that it will be able to handle and will be able to be done. What I just described is a little bit complex. I recommend that you ask a shayla if you have the case, but my point is, ask the shayla, because if you go through the details and you see it could be kashered, it's well worthwhile. Yeah.
So two questions. The first is in the toaster oven. What if the bottom, because you said it dripped down, what if there's no tray on the bottom? So how would you go ahead? Could you kosher that at that point? And
it's,
number two, the food that you cooked from a milchik pot into, you cooked fleishiks in it by accident, are you still able to eat the food that's cooked in it?
So, the deal with the toaster oven, obviously it's a practical case. There are a lot of considerations. It's not simple to kosher or whatever, but that's, in terms of, is the item edible? The answer is yes. If it's eina ben yomo taste, the item is going to be edible. That is the most practical kashrus shaila that ever gets asked. Person used a milchik fork to stir meatballs, to dish out meatballs. We will ask, what is milchik about the fork? And if we're told, I used it for milchik last week, 4 days ago, then the fork is eino ben yomo milchik, and it is not going to trafe up your meatballs because it's emitting old, bad taste. The fork, at this point, has milchiks and fleishiks in it. Even after 24 hours, you wait. But it's got milchiks and fleishiks in it, and the fork definitely will have to be kashered.
I was curious, you can eat that food, but can you put it in your regular fleishik bowls?
Yes.
Okay.
It is not considered trafed. It's fine. Okay?
So the toaster oven issue is only a problem on where that kishka dripped on. It's not a problem on the walls or...
I'm not saying it's fine. I gave you an example. I'm not telling you to paskin the shayla. You're correct. What about the walls? What about the smell? What about the taste? What about the steam? What about a lot of factors? Correct. I'm just using it as an illustration of a fundamental point. You could have milchiks, fleishiks together, but because one of them is old, it's called pogum, distasteful, and therefore it's defined as hetera bola. It's kosher. As much as it's not kosher, and it's got to be kashered, but which method of kashering could be utilized? And the method of kashering that can be utilized in this case, even though it's an open flame type thing, is the lesser, the liquid method. And that basically saves the product. This is discussed in this long paragraph that we don't have time for right now, marked Chametz. But the reason the Mishneh Berurah says you can't apply this to Chametz, even though logically one would argue that when I am kashering for Pesach, I'm kashering something that when it was absorbed, it was kosher. When it was absorbed, it was during the year, it was kosher. But the Mishneh Berurah paskens that during the year it's also called Chametz. It's just that chametz is permitted during the year. When it was absorbed, it was called chametz. And therefore, when you kasher it, you have to use the higher level of kashering because you're kashering chametz in order to use the item on Pesach. And on Pesach, chametz, which is what it absorbed, is forbidden. So it absorbed chametz when chametz was permitted. But now I'm kashering for when chametz is forbidden. You had a question, Don?
Just a little thing about the fork and being used previously, milk. Do I care whether the milk was hot or cold?
Of course. One of the biggest considerations is, I understand the item was used with milchik or fleishik, but was it used with hot milchik or fleishik? In most cases, if it was used cold, it will not be affected. The exceptions are if either the item was very spicy, then even though it's cold, but it's halachically hot. And secondly, if it's soaked in the item. So that if you left a fork in a milchik dish, or you left the spoon inside the meatballs, and it was soaking there, that would be the equivalent of hot, kavush kemevushal. Soaked is the same as cooked. But normally, cold will be a saving grace. Yeah?
How long is soaked?
Soaked is 24 hours. Kavush kumavushal on a non-spicy item. If it's spicy, it's much less time. Moving on towards the bottom of page 1. Echad kli eitz, wooden items, ve'echad kli even, stone items, ve'echad kli matchis, and metal items, dinam lachshiram bahagola, they can all be kashered. So again, wood, stone, and metal can be kashered. That's where it comes from, that some people prefer marble countertops, because they want to be able to kasher them for Pesach, etc. It becomes a little bit of a discussion, exactly how to kasher, how hot does the water have to be, do you have to hit every single inch? It becomes a little detailed. This is our prop for that topic. This has been manufactured. We can debate its effectiveness, but the idea is that you put this on the fire, you boil it up, and then you're able to cause a very controlled pouring on every inch of the countertop. This is a kli rishon. This is the original vessel. It was on the fire, and as I'm pouring it, I'm producing kashering water to kasher on every inch, as opposed to the careless type method, where you just take this off the pot and you go, whoosh! Which has strong halachic debate. I mean, I hear it, but we need to appreciate that there's a debate on it because the water is sloshing across. It hit here. At what point does it lose its Kli Rishon status? I'd rather just leave it as a question because I agree. I mean, I understand the whole place is steaming hot. But leave it as a question. At what point does it, in fact, lose its Kli Rishon status? Clearly, if I started at one end of the table, gave a slosh, and it made it all the way to the other side, I cannot magically say, you know, the whole counter was Christianed. You know, it's just like, ta-da, magic, the rabbi blessed it. I mean, did it get kashered or didn't it get kashered? There's an old school of thought that said, slosh hot water across it, and then use an iron to heat the water up. It's not actually as outrageous as it sounds, especially if you grew up in yeshiva and you learned how to do pizza on the back of an iron. It's not, you know, so far-fetched to heat up water. I mean, that's when you iron pants. You add some water and you, it heats it up.
Do you have to kasher the iron?
Yes, from the pizza, you have to kasher the iron. The starch, right.
So when you have this big sink and you know, you're slowly dipping hot water around it, is it better to start sort of near the drain and work out, or is there, does it matter? Because
the way I do it is I start with the walls, and I work my way around, waiting for the water to basically drain. I don't believe you have to be so intense and literally dry everything perfectly, but you know, I imagine some people may say you have to. I'm not, you know, but do it with generous hot water, heat, each quadrant as I describe it, so that you know you're really just not sloshing it, it's magically kashered, but that you actually kashered each quadrant. There are other methods to some people. One of the kashrus agencies recommends that if you'd use a ladle, if you left the ladle in the pot to the point that it's literally boiling over, so then they hold that the ladle becomes a Kli Rishon. And then you have enormous control and you don't waste too much water in each. I don't know if it works. I personally think that sloshing one quadrant at a time works. It really does. The water's coming out at high heat, and it's kashering every inch. And to me, that works. The only consideration is to make sure that you're willing to boil up 3 to 4 pots of water, and you're willing to do that.
So yeah. What just does something that we do is, you never come to our house again. But if we have a big,
it's always good to ask those questions in public.
It's okay. It's not a question. Big pot like that, we boil it up, it's really hot. We have a small pot on another flame. We'll scoop out the hot water from the big pot and put it on the other flame, get that boiling, and then we can go around with that smaller pot, which is on the Kli Rishon, and kosher the bowl. It's not a big.
If it's been boiled up on the fire, then it's a Kli Rishon. If it's been boiled up on the fire, but that needs
so
to be done.
Wait so long to get it boiled.
Every family has their own little tricks.
When you're doing like with that, though, how hot does the water have to be? Since you take it off the flame, it's no longer going to be, you know, percolating, boiling. So, like, you know, what's...
It's considered Kli Rishon, at least for the moments that you need to get it to its destination.
Yeah. So, expand on that, if the small pot that you put in the big pot doesn't cool the water in the big pot, that small pot is a Kli Rishon as well, right?
The one that you've immersed has to be left in long enough that it becomes a Kli Rishon. Over here, it actually helps to have gone through the scholarship background, and I'm just giving you the snippets, but in the scholarship background, there are those that say that ladle is a Kli Sheni, They hold it like that for Hilchas Shabbos. They hold it's a kli sheni. And there are those who hold it's a kli rishon. And the compromise psak on a practical level is it depends how long it stayed in.
How long does it need to be in? Check if it's thin and it heats up fast.
Acheyetze asafek milibo. Until you're confident that it is now a kli rishon. The boiling is happening. The ladle is in there. The ladle absorbed the heat. There's nothing cliché-y about it anymore. It may just require quite a bit of patience more than anything. Okay? Let me move along so that we could just hit the highlights, and then if there are any questions, my pleasure to stay. Glass on the bottom of the page. Glass, according to Ashkenazim, is fascinating. In general, we're very lenient on glass. Corel, for example, other glassware, we're lenient, even though you are obligated to have milchik and fleishik separate, but if a botch-up occurs, we're extremely lenient. In most cases, you're simply going to wash it clean and keep moving. When we start with balei tshuva, getting used to the separation of milchik's fleishik's, we often recommend korel, so that if mistakes happen, it doesn't mean that they're always kasher. It just makes it a lot easier. Those leniencies work, but not for Pesach. If you look at the text, Kli Zuchuches, the Mechaber writes, Afilu Machnisam Lekiyam, even if you've got stuff in there for a very long time, Afilu Mishtamish Be'em Chamin, you leave it there with hot water, Ein Tzrichim Shom Hechsher, the Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, holds it doesn't need kashering, She'einam bolin, because glass does not absorb. B'shtifa ba'al masagiluhu, all you have to do is rinse it. Hagah, but the Rama writes, and this is the way we paskin, yesh machmirim, we're strict on this, ve'omrim, and we say, dekli zuchuchis afilo hagala lo mahani, even hagala will not work on glass. V'chein ha-minig ba'ashkenaz, and that's the established minig among Ashkenazim, that glass cannot be kashered, and it would need, it doesn't work for Pesach. This gets extrapolated to lots of other issues, such as plastic. During the year, we are lenient, and we allow plastic to be kashered. You have a batch up, hot, kasher it. Kasher it. No problem. For Pesach, no way. Same thing with countertops. Countertops that are of some sort of synthetic. So if they were marble, so it's stone, you could kasher it. If it's a synthetic, we right away react and say, don't kasher it, instead cover it. And that's all based on this same thing, that the Rama is strict when it comes to kashering. We're limited to metal, wood, and stone. Yeah?
So I thought, I learned that when it comes to glass, that you didn't use for hot, you changed water 3 times over...
There is a method of kashering for glass that was not used with hot. It is not commonly practiced. If someone wants to do it, I could include it in step 2 of such a session. It turns out I planned this as 2 sessions. It turns out that we have a community chasna next week, so we're not doing next week. So I kind of crammed whatever I could into the 1 session. But yes, that is a method of kashering that, if we go further into this, is worth discussing. The concept is that it's soaked in water for 24-hour periods, 3 of them, changing the water in between. Okay. If an item is not being kashered for Pesach, all you have to do is clean it well and put it away. In the documents where we sell chametz to the goy, so some documents write that we're selling any chametz that's adhered to the pots. So if you got a noodle underneath the handle and you overlooked it, he can have it. And the guy is fine with that because he knows the sweeping mechira that we want. Usually he makes a few dollars on the deal and whatever. He's okay with that. Likewise, there are those who write in the document that any chametz absorbed in the vessel is included in the mechira. That's really not necessary. But if you want to write that, you could write it. What you don't want to write is that you're selling him your vessels. Because if you sold him your vessels, when you take them back after Pesach, you would have to put them in a mikveh to upgrade them again to a kosher kitchen. So just to put things in perspective, when cleaning for Pesach, there is room for leniency and to assume that things in the home are more or less clean, and we have a backup clause in the mechira just in case we overlooked something. And if that helps people not to be so intense about the cleaning, that's a great thing. That's for items that are not being koshered. Okay. One final item that I want to mention. It's particularly advanced, but if you sat through this whole session, you're entitled to something intriguing and advanced. And that's the question of china. I feel like a magician. If I don't break it in the process, I'll really be doing magic. Okay. China cannot be koshered. We know that. Can't be koshered. It's earthenware. What happens if a person is going kosher, and they have a gorgeous set of china, and Baal Tshuva does not really want to give up this gorgeous set of china, especially if it was bought for them by their mother-in-law? They don't want to give it up. What can you do? So this is extremely advanced. Don't practice this on your own. It needs consultation. But there are two methods that you should be aware of before taking matters into your own hand and smashing it all. Two methods. One method is machziro likivshon. You put it back into the original smelting furnace type heat. And that would be considered a kashering. Some authorities maintain that putting such a product into a self-cleaning oven is the equivalent of machziro likivshan. It's enormous high heat. And they maintain that such a kashering is acceptable in a case of potential significant loss. And they allow that. That's one method. The biggest two disadvantages of that method are, number one, at that high heat, if it has fancy coloration, it could get discolored. And secondly, the heat is provably very hot to the point that some of the utensils may break. And that's why it's not the ultimate method, even if we accept that it's the equivalent of machziro likivshan on a practical level. It's not so perfect. There is another method which is mentioned by Reb Moshe, and that method is that you age the china for more than 12 months, and together with a number of other considerations that he outlines in a tshuva, he says you can, in addition, immerse it in a hechsher method of hot water three times. Now, three times does not mean that you simply dump it in three times. Keep in mind, even if you add the best heat and water resistant, when you put it in, there's a part that's not being kashered, the part that you're holding. So you're putting it in, and then you're putting it in a second time, and that's one kashering, according to this method. You can go ahead and do other plates, bowls, serving dishes, but this plate and all of the ones that follow it were only kashered once so far. Rav Moshe is describing, based on one of the Rishonim, that if you kasher it three times, then whatever comes out the first time, whatever comes out the second time, whatever comes out the third time, especially because it's all 12 month old, he says that would be acceptable together with whatever other considerations. What method of kashering are we describing if a Rav tells you you can do it? He's describing putting it in both sides. That's one. You do the rest of the set. Empty the water. New water in. You do it a second time. And you repeat that process, dumping the water, refilling it, reboiling, doing it a third time. If a Rav recommends it, that method can definitely salvage the set. When I came to town, there were a number of people that told me that they got a psak from their Rav regarding their china, that they should wait 12 months and then get back to me. This is what was being described. Wait 12 months, age it. There's an opinion in the Rishonim that once it's 12 months old, we don't have to worry about what's absorbed. In addition, there's an opinion that cheres can be kashered three-time method is going to work. Whatever else Rav Moshe puts into the mix, there's such a method of kashering. What's important to me is simply to share that it exists, and if someone tells you to do it, it's labor-intensive, but it'll save the set. Question. We hold that china does not have to be put into the mikvah, even though it's glazed. We hold that fundamentally it's cheres, and cheres does not require mikvah. You can't do the second and third in the same water. When we say that it has to be kashered three times, there has to be a distinction. It can't be the same water.
But can you put the mesh and then the water thrown out?
The mesh works. It's a nice creative way. It's no different than all the other creative methods that we have to hold the item. The mesh, you would give it a little agitation so that it's kashering the whole product, and you pull it out. And like this, you could immerse it the whole way. That's great. Okay? I'm going to conclude and then accept questions. So thank you, everyone, for coming. Question. If anybody wants to leave, I know that we're close to an hour and a half.